Get me for free. Courtesy of Yelp for Restaurant. Tools and tactics are what's going to make you successful in 2024. Yelp for Restaurants has the tools you need to scale your restaurant this year, and I'm here to help. Sign up for a consultation with Yelp Guest Manager and get a free one-hour coaching session with me. In our session, we'll dive deep into your restaurant and build the blueprint to overcome your current obstacles and scale your profitability. You can sign up for both free sessions by simply going to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp today. I'll see you soon. Now here we go.
We have to figure out how to make the industry more professional, more stable, have less waves of financial instability. Somehow we need to figure out how to create a financial model, and we need to make it a financially stable industry so that the return on investment is more rewarding.
Welcome to Full Comp, a show offering insight into the hospitality industry, featuring restaurateurs, thought leaders, and innovators. Served up on the house. Are you on track to hit your profitability goals for this year? If you're struggling to hit your numbers, I might be able to help. Here's how I do it. Every year, I offer 5 complimentary growth sessions to restaurant owners looking to scale. In this call, we'll examine your current situation to see what is and isn't working. We'll identify your growth possibilities by the close of the year. We'll uncover the number one thing holding you and your business back. And we'll develop a growth plan that will get your business results. Go to planwithjosh.com to schedule one of the 5 complimentary growth sessions. They're going to go quickly. They always do. I believe restaurants have always had a pervasive culture, albeit at times not the healthiest culture. Restaurateur Ellen Yin is out to change that, and she's leading by example. Today we sit down to discuss her unorthodox path through the industry and how, in breaking the mold, she's developed a formula to heal the industry.
I, like so many probably restaurateurs, maybe yourself even, that you fell in love with it in high school. I don't know if you worked in a restaurant when you were in high school, but I worked in a restaurant in my hometown in Monmouth County, New Jersey, and it was the place where I felt the most invigorated, the most like I felt like I belonged, and especially being Asian in a non-Asian community and being in high school where I had really grown up in that high school. We moved around and it was a place where I didn't really connect with that many people. The restaurant was a place where I felt very much like the part of the family and everybody working on the team to make an experience. And that's where I fell in love with restaurants. I always loved food and I loved taking care of people and service because my mother was an incredible entertainer, but it was the restaurant where I really felt like I really want to pursue this as a career. And of course, that was disappointing to my parents. And I tried every which way to kind of maneuver into it. But I came to Philadelphia to go to college and pretty much never left and spent most of my 20s trying to figure out how to make that dream come true, even though I was working in other industries.
Let's talk about that, because for me, that was a life hack. Same deal, right? The first time I walked into a bar, I was 17 years old in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I didn't see the people on the floor. I saw the bartenders. And when I saw the bar, I saw a stage. And I was like, this is for me. And if someone was to ask me, what is the greatest professional life hack there is? It's like, for a select few of us, we know what we're going to do from a very young age. And again, whether you venture out into other industries or not, and I certainly did myself for a short time, you always know where you're going to land. And everything is kind of leading you in that general direction. It's one thing to work in our industry. It's another thing to aspire to become a restaurateur. What inspired that in you? Were there models that you saw that seemed inspirational?
Well, for me, I feel like it's almost like a piece of art. Restaurants are an experience, and it's a sensual experience in terms of the food that you eat, the sound that you hear, the visual that you see, the people who are there on stage. And I'm a little bit of a creative person, so I always saw it that as that. I don't know that I was necessarily thinking I'm going to kill it as a financial investment, or that I aspired to be a restaurateur as my career path, but I love the idea of creating this idea and making a place for people to feel comfortable and at home. And that's what inspired me.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the transition there, if there was a transition. So, samesies. When I got into it, it wasn't about money. It was about glory. I wanted to create something great. I wanted to dedicate it to the community. And what I found, especially in those early years as a restaurateur, was that profit was an obligation. I know it was like the shameful thing in our industry to actually make money, but I equated profit with impact. I needed to make money, and I needed to make more money because I wanted to do more things. And what stifled my ability to double down and host amazing community events and give away things for free in a way that didn't bankrupt the company, all of it came down to a function of profitability. So was there a moment in your career where it went from being about the glory to being about the glory and the impact?
Well, you can't have glory if the place can't stay open. And the place can't stay open if there's not a surplus of cash coming in, because at some point you'll burn out of all the cash. So I would say that it's a necessity, not a preference, that everybody needs to care about profitability, because there's no way that you can last more than 3 months if you just don't care about where you're at, or just dumb luck. And that is a major challenge. And you hear so many stories about how restaurants only have a 1 year life, that 50% of restaurants close within a year, or the margins are razor thin. All those things that you hear about restaurants doesn't deter anybody, because even during the pandemic, people were opening restaurants despite the fact of knowing how financially challenging it is. So there's something there that just causes us all to like love this industry, but you have to make a surplus. Otherwise, it's going to be a really difficult road.
I find the optimism, and I possess it myself. I find it so inspiring. I joke all the time. I say, most new restaurants open in closed restaurants. It's the great irony of our business. Most aren't fresh builds, right? And so that being the case, there have to be these differentiating factors between those that consistently succeed and those that intermittently fail. In your mind, as a student of the industry yourself, what's the delta? What are the differences between intermittently succeeding and succeeding with consistency?
Well, one thing is, I think that there has to be a roadmap, right? I mean, you can be as creative as you want. Use the best ingredients that you want. Or you could have a model that's like, to use your example of a dive bar. A dive bar still has a vision, but if you aren't in the right place, you aren't open the right hours, whatever your business decision-making is, if it doesn't work, there's something amiss with it. So if you don't have a roadmap, you have to at least have a roadmap to say, I'm sticking with this, and not just be all over the place. Because when you're all over the place, money tends to be harder to keep track of, and if it's unfocused, I think you're not making a statement to anybody. It can be really challenging. But having a roadmap is essential. Being able to control the creative impulses that we all have. I mean, even as a dive bar, and I'm not even saying Michelin-starred restaurant or not, dive bar, if you just have bartenders who want everything, it's like candy, and the liquor list is like, what's it saying? Whatever, in the candy store, you see all these different things that you could get and you're buying them, but not necessarily able to convert them into something that's of value to your customer. That ultimately is the reason why businesses fail, because you're not offering something that's of value, whether it's price to whatever, people not willing to pay the price or people not wanting the product, whatever it is, it has to be something that people want to spend the money on. Otherwise, you're dead as no water.
What you're talking about specifically is product market fit. In my mind, when we look at the success or failure of any restaurant, it really comes down to two things, right? Product market fit. And if you've achieved that, then it's just about awareness. if you have what they want, then you just need to let them know. Because there is no, and I, Lord knows I tried this for so many years, there's no manufacturing demand. Either people want it or they don't. And so as you've opened multiple concepts in multiple tiers over the years, what does that product market fit engine look like for you? How do you guys decide whether this is right for this particular community?
Well, it's so interesting because you could look at it in so many different ways, but the bottom line is you have to have enough customers to field your concept. And the more niche your concept is, the more people you need to be able to attract, because it may or may not be a multiple time experience depending on what your concept is. So what I found is that although I don't want to appeal, no one can appeal to everybody, but you might have to make something on the menu that is a compromise, that is not 100% your most creative thing, but it's something that when a table of four comes in and one person wants Michelin style, whatever, and one person is a steak and potatoes person, or one person is vegetarian, you have to create that product mix that at least can attract a broader quantity of people, because otherwise it's very difficult to accommodate people when you're that niche. So we don't have any super niche restaurants. Fork, our flagship restaurant, it's a, for lack of a better word, restaurant focused on sourcing and farm to table and about American cuisine. And it's more about the service and hospitality than it is necessarily the food. So if you're taking people out, you have a special occasion, you don't want it to fail. Fork is a place that you can rely on, that you know you're going to have a 98% in terms of food service and just overall experience. High Street is a little bit different. It's more about bread, something that I'm super passionate about. But I realized that I am nixing all the gluten-free people out. So I have to have gluten-free options. And obviously, that makes total sense. I mean, nobody can just be 100% everything unless you're small. And there are certainly, Philadelphia is a city where the barrier to entry is really low. You could open up a 20-seat restaurant, a 30-seat restaurant, and you can do it. You can live your dream. But if you want to grow, 20 seats is really hard to like get out of, because it's hard to afford a liquor license. It's hard to afford management and team members. You're basically a one-man show. So if you want to get from small little 20-seater to 60-seater, I had the luxury of when I opened at 68 seats, and I was able to raise enough money to build out a restaurant of that size, but a lot of people can't.
Let's go back to Fork for a second, because I'm sure that some people that are unfamiliar with the concept will listen to your description of the concept and say, what a square. I'm not here to just do the do. I'm here to innovate. I'm here to change the world. When the reality is that restaurateurs prize innovation, but restaurant customers prize consistency. They want to know that you're reliable. And I don't think there are enough conversations happening around consistency. Despite how you described it, it was one of the top 100 restaurants America can afford to lose.
Well, we've had 5 chefs over 25 years, and I am not a chef. So therefore, to create consistency, it's about creating the value, about creating the hospitality vision, about creating the healing of consistency, because over 5 chefs, they're all different. I mean, I can't force any of them to cook the other person's food. They're all cooking their own food, but they all have to operate within that vision and that sandbox and that value proposition. So I think that people who want to push the limits of creativity, remember, creativity comes with a cost. It comes with sometimes higher labor costs, sometimes higher ingredient costs. And that all goes into your business model of deciding whether or not you have enough of a market size to feed into your concept. And people who are overly ambitious, like if you want to do that super high-end concept, most likely it can't be in a 100-seat restaurant, because a 100-seat restaurant to occupy, to fill, to pay the rent on that amount of space, you have to have a really big audience. So those two things may or may not, I'm not saying it can never happen, but it depends on the marketplace you're in. Maybe in Philadelphia it can't work, but in Chicago it can work. Or in a suburb of Philadelphia it can work. But only if you do the math and do the homework and the research and what is actually happening in that marketplace do you really understand what it could be.
One of the things that I talk about a lot with my clients is this marketing concept of jobs to be done. Are you familiar?
Yeah. Well, actually, I want to hear your version of jobs to be done, and then I'll tell you my version of jobs to be
done. Sure. Sounds good. So the idea is this, is that it's not a restaurant that nobody's going to you to eat because they can eat at home. Your restaurant serves a specific purpose in their life, that it's a specific use case. My fine dining restaurant, it was about revelry. We were there to celebrate every major occasion in your life, and you could trust us to do so. At the dive bar, we were an antidote to loneliness. Like when I described the bar to other people, I said, this is a bar you can go to by yourself, and you'll meet the bartenders, they'll become your friends, they'll introduce you to the other regulars at the bar. That was the job. So in no way have I described food or beverage. That's not our job. Our job is experience. And so one of the questions that I ask a lot, and I think you're talking about it as it relates to product market fit, is like, what is the job of your restaurant? Because ultimately that's going to determine frequency. And frequency is the name of the game. In fine dining, frequency, no matter how good of a job you do, customers are infrequent. The people that can afford to come all the time can afford to go other places. So they do. And so it's all a function of that in my mind. How about you?
Well, I can definitely relate to that. I was thinking more about jobs to be done on a labor perspective, because you can create as many jobs to be done, but whether or not they support your mission or not is another question. But in terms of jobs to be done, yes, I agree that each restaurant serves a specific purpose. And that purpose, it's funny because having a restaurant group, and especially with concepts that are a little bit similar, there is sibling rivalry. And when one sees one doing really well at something, then they automatically want that for themselves. But you have to differentiate and you have to kind of stay in your lane, because there are a certain number of customers who like our style of hospitality and food and service. And maybe that is a limited audience as well. So gotta definitely have to take that into consideration. I love your dive bar that you are a solution for loneliness, because the Fork Bar, for example, is a place where people have come and meet people, and it's very convivial. Even though it's in a gorgeous dining room, people feel comfortable. People feel like they belong, that they're going to meet people with a similar vision of themselves. So that is something that it does. And then the rest of the dining room continues to be special occasion, people celebrating, people doing deals, people definitely on the higher end side. High Street Hoagies, that's a solution to your lunch problem, but that's the one we have the most struggle with, because our vision of a lunch problem might not be the same vision as a bunch of students. We're in a student food hall, and we're finding that we are not connecting the dots on that, and whether or not we just need to move it, because we have a version of that at High Street Bakery where it's killing it, where the students are residents of a university hospital who maybe have more spending income or want a more sophisticated product. Our hoagies are delicious, but they are $15, where maybe undergraduates only want to spend $8 or $9. And maybe that's a disconnect.
Let's unpack that. I think that there are a lot of people that are in that position today, right? Wondering, you know, do I need to pivot this concept, or do I need to take it out back and shoot it? And we go back and forth with this. I mean, I don't know about you, but I can tell you that my life has been defined professionally by either giving up too quick or not giving up quick enough. I would say that that ultimately is the hurdle for so many of us. And sometimes you're able to make one or two pivots and the whole thing turns around. And then sometimes it's just a slog in perpetuity. How do you delineate in your mind? And maybe for this specific concept, but maybe generally, when do you know that there is an opportunity here? And when do you know that it's time to just take the loss?
I'm probably in the slog category because I'm optimistic. I always feel like I could turn it around. But as an entrepreneur, you're a risk taker, and you have to understand that everything that you do, no matter how successful you've been in the past or how good of a student you are or how great you are with people, that every entrepreneurial venture, whether it's consulting, whether it's opening a restaurant, has a risk to it. Maybe being a consultant has less risk and restaurant ownership definitely has high risk, but there is a possibility that you could fail or that you can't turn it around. And I was in a situation where I tried everything I possibly could to turn a situation around and I couldn't do it. And the bottom line was that maybe it was bad timing, maybe it was bad luck, maybe it was nothing that had to do with me, because the amount of attention that the concept got, the amount of reviews, positive feedback that we received, but we could never make it work. And the rent turned out to just be too high for the concept that we had. And so there was nothing that I could do, but I just kept trying and trying and trying and bleeding and bleeding and bleeding. And then finally, I knew that I just couldn't keep it up and pulled the plug. And that was probably 3 years too late, maybe even 4 years too late or 5 years too late. Who knows?
Well, the problem in my mind, it's not the money, it's the time.
Right, yeah.
It's understanding as an entrepreneur that your most valuable asset is your time. It's your focus.
That's right. That's right. And one of my investors said to me right out from the gate, maybe you should just try to make money someplace else. And that was an incredible piece of advice, which I didn't take. But when I look back, I remember it clear as a bell, sitting in his office and him telling me, maybe cut your losses early and move on to something else that could make money. And in retrospect, in my career, that was a lesson well learned.
Let's talk about Philadelphia generally. So I moved to Los Angeles in like 2000. And I would say Los Angeles is this beautiful culinary destination today. But it was a food desert when I moved there, right? Because we hadn't pulled all the chefs from New York yet. And now I'm seeing this resurgence south in San Diego, that they're beginning to pull chefs from Los Angeles down to improve the culinary scene here. But you look at Philadelphia and you say that when you opened Fork, Philadelphia certainly wasn't the food destination that it is today. And that you guys really set the stage for that. Talk to me about building something that the community needs and isn't asking for. How do you do that in a way that resonates and resonates for as long as it has?
Well, apparently they did need it, because at the time that Fork opened, the culinary scene was not what it was. So there was high-end dining like Le Bec Fen, which was a premier French restaurant. And then there was BYOB, which is what I was saying earlier, that anybody can open. So mom and pop shop versus high-end French dining, what's in between? There was nothing in between. So I was able to fit in there as the in-between. But as time moved forward, there were economic changes like 9/11, then 2008, a major economic crisis. So over those years, we were able, because we were in the middle, we were able to kind of morph into things that people wanted or didn't want. At some points, Fork was the highest end dining experience that you could have, maybe not like La Croix or like that type of dining, but for kind of casual upscale dining, it was a little bit on the more edgy side. It achieved four bells from the Philadelphia Inquirer critic. And that was in year 15. As the chef-driven restaurant movement continued to escalate, we were able to ride that wave. But after the pandemic, we had to really think about what is it that people are looking for. And I felt that people were looking for someplace that they felt comfortable, belonging. They were looking for the community, not necessarily the high-end dining. They're definitely not looking for comfort food because they've been doing that the whole time. But now, as things are starting to return in Philadelphia, I'm feeling like, when you look at Fork and people go by saying, that's a really nice restaurant, this is exactly how I felt in 2015, that there's an opportunity to keep pushing that envelope forward. And we certainly have the service staff to be able to succeed in that market. And that's why I'm doing the renovation, because I want to be able to push that. So that's how over 25 years, I've been able to kind of morph, evolve, pivot, if you really want to use that word. I wouldn't say pivot, because we didn't really pivot during the pandemic, but how I've thought about my market and where I stand in relative to other restaurants in the industry.
One of the most educational and arguably painful facets of my career is that I flirted with other tiers of dining. That once I felt like I achieved some semblance of mastery, I wanted to dive headfirst into other tiers of dining. And I would argue you've had a similar path. Talk to me about what you've learned about fine dining from casual dining and what you've learned about casual dining from fast casual. Because what I found is all of the lessons kind of blend together, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So our first kind of dip into more casual dining was just expanding next door to Fork, a little cafe called Fork Etc., which was all prepared foods, all baked products. We had this bistro table in the middle of the room, which was awesome because we eventually started using the space for dining as a private dining room for receptions. People loved it because it was just kind of relaxed. And that space could never become a restaurant. For whatever reason, it was really frustrating because we tried everything. And also, the chefs could not understand prepared foods. Prepared foods are a totally different animal than plated food. And so you almost have to have an additional team focused on prepared foods and food to go because they're just not the same. But I'm so thankful I did it because we evolved Fork Etc. into High Street, and High Street suffered from some of the same things that we had learned from Fork Etc., in that people kept thinking it was a daytime thing or a nighttime thing, and they couldn't see it as being either or. They could only see it as one or the other. And that's a really interesting component, because if you're open for breakfast, people don't see you as a nighttime option. If you're open for dinner, people don't see you as a breakfast option. Like an all-day cafe, although we help coin the word all-day cafe, it's a really hard proposition. And you have to remember, diners are an all-day cafe. Coffee shops are an all-day cafe. Now there are bars that are all-day cafes. It's almost like ubiquitous, like farm to table. But what we learned from Fork Etc. was that it's really hard to be everything to everybody. So when we turned into High Street and it was immediately successful in the daytime, it's kind of weird because Fork Etc. was successful in the daytime, but never at nighttime. And then when we opened in New York, people kept coming up to me and saying, hey, what are you opening for dinner? But yet we insisted on opening for lunch. So that was something that I wish I could have wheeled backwards.
Sure.
Because I didn't realize that New York was such a dinner market. You have to have dinner and you have to have a bar. And yet we ripped out the bar because we thought it should be focused on food and bread. So we didn't listen to our learnings. And then during the pandemic, when we had to move out of High Street, we opened a small version of High Street that was completely to go and take out. And it is extremely popular, but there was no option for dine-in. And so now we opened the dine-in version of it, but it's so hard to get the team to kind of be able to manage both.
Right.
It's really hard. So still trying to take those learnings and figure it all out.
Last year, the James Beard Foundation awarded you the award for Outstanding Restaurateur. In your mind, what qualities make for an outstanding restaurateur?
Well, there are so many talented restaurateurs, and for whatever reason, I was noticed last year. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the work that we do outside of the restaurant, and how we're using the restaurant and the group's platform to transform other things. Like, we started a project called Wonton Project, which I didn't know what a ghost kitchen was. And my solution to a problem is try as many different things as you can, see what sticks. And so during the pandemic, when Fork was closed, I was teetering around in the kitchen trying to figure out whether I could turn my mother's wonton recipes into a ghost kitchen concept. And ultimately, that's what we landed on, because it doesn't have a storefront and you can only order to go and delivery. But the Wonton Project became a response to AAPI discrimination and hate. And then also, Sisterly Love Collective is something that I'm super passionate about and try to get our team involved as much as possible. But it's really to elevate the voices of women in business, particularly those in the food and hospitality space, but we do work with other women as well, but really trying to elevate and help them grow. Because even now, after so many years of being a woman restaurateur, when I go to a meeting that's about business, I'm still the minority in the room. And it's very hard to access capital if you don't know what to do. And women don't necessarily have that support system of knowing who they can ask. They don't necessarily have mentors because they are a minority in the field. I think that there are a lot of women who work in the industry, but in leadership positions, or particularly ownership, they are still a minority. And I think what women have realized is that food is an opportunity. And so many people during the pandemic decided, I don't want to be what I was doing before. I want to run my life the way that I want to. And maybe food is an opportunity to do that.
As you try and break the mold, it's easy to look at the existing rules in our industry, right? There's so many rules and so many traditions about how things should be done in our industry. How would you like to see the industry overall turn the tables to create a better future for all of us?
Well, I think if we want to continue to have quality team members, we have to figure out how to make the industry more professional, more stable, have less waves of financial instability. It's wintertime, for example, it's dead, or springtime, it's busy. Somehow we need to figure out how to create a financial model. And for our own sanity and future, we need to make it a more stable, financially stable industry so that the return on investment is more rewarding, because people give up so much to do this industry, missing holidays, missing their families, traveling, all that. It takes so much effort to make it all work. Of course, that could be said about any entrepreneurial venture. I mean, anything. I'm sure you work the same number of hours that you worked when you were a restaurateur, maybe a little bit less, but maybe you have a little bit more flexibility. But we need to get rid of that perception. People always ask me about work-life balance. How do I achieve work-life balance? Well, I love what I do. So if I'm happy, then I have work-life balance. So I just want to make sure that I'm not worrying every day about whether or not I have enough for retirement, whether I have enough to support my team and grow my team. Those are the things that, by solving this problem, that we can help the industry.
Our industry suffers from razor-thin margins, and the only way for us to ensure profitability is to make data-driven decisions. The numbers don't lie, and Yelp for Restaurants just released some incredibly compelling numbers. For starters, Yelp reaches 9 times more customers online than OpenTable. And when restaurants pair that level of visibility with Guest Manager and Yelp ads, they experience up to an 8% lift in diner bookings. Think about what that 8% lift could do for your restaurant's finances. To learn more about how Yelp for Restaurants can support your business, visit restaurants.yelp.com/full comp to learn more today. That's Ellen Yin. For more information on Ellen and her restaurant group, visit highstreethospitality.com. If you want to tell us your story, hear previous episodes, or check out our other content, go to restaurants.yelp.com/full comp. Thank you so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, please leave us a review. A special thanks to Yelp for helping us spread the word to the whole hospitality community. I'm Josh Kopel. You've been listening to Full Comp.